Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome to Law Librarian Conversations on Blog Talk Radio, the podcast about all things law library, legal bibliography, and the law library profession. Thanks for joining us. Okay, well, thank you very much, everybody, for joining us. Doesn't that sound like a professional introduction? I almost feel like I'm on the radio or something. Well, thank you for joining us and for everybody that's on the panel. We have a very exciting show for you in store today. My name's Richard Leiter. I'm your host of Law Librarian Conversations. And joining me in studio, such as it is, from the executive suites. See, Greg, we don't have a C-suite. We have executive suites here at the Mighty Schmid Law Library's Marcia Doherty Baker. And then across the land, we have quite a panel. Let's see, starting from the West Coast, and let's work our way east, see if I can do this. Holly Riccio, our exalted president of AALL, joining us from San Francisco.
Hi.
Hello.
There.
Hey there. And then moving east, Melissa Bernstein from Salt Lake City, University of Utah.
Hi.
And Sarah Glassmeyer from Cali, regular panel. Hey there. That's right, Melissa, you're a first-timer on the podcast, aren't you?
Yes, I am. I've been a listener, but never a presenter, so thank you.
Uh-huh. Welcome aboard. And then, let's see, Greg Lambert down in Texas.
Hello.
And I have to say, one of our your candidate or nominee for AALL president and former executive board member. And you know, just so that I'm not playing favorites, Diane Rodriguez is your opponent. So
yes.
Equal time there.
I cried when I learned that I was having to go up against one of my best friends for this.
I mean, that's one of the problems with running for anything in this profession. We're too small not to know everybody else. And heck, we are a profession filled with pretty nice, likable people for the most part. So yeah, you've got it tough there.
Yeah.
And then further east, Ken Hirsch from Cincinnati and executive board member. And it's an executive board member and karaoke aficionado.
Thank you for
the University of Cincinnati. And then, did I get everybody? Last but not least, in Washington, D.C., from the Government Affairs Office, Government Relations Office, we have Emily Feltrin, our Director of Public – wait a minute. I can never get the name right. Director of Government Relations.
That's Emily. Right. Hi, everyone.
And Elizabeth Holland, our Public Policy Associate.
Hi, Rich.
Hey there. Okay.
And with all the introductions, we're about out of time, so thanks for joining.
Good show, everyone.
So, let's see. I just wanted to mention a couple of things. There's been a lot, actually, happening lately, and a few things that we just need to mention for all of our guests and and just to be sure that we touch on them before we break up today. One thing that I had from my notes from the last podcast that we did that I just wanted to mention and point out was that Duke announced that it was ceasing all print of its law reviews. As far as I know, they're the only first and only like major law review that has stopped publishing in print altogether. Does anybody think that's interesting or weird or scary or otherwise?
I think it's interesting. It's a good first step. Now we just need to get them to stop publishing in PDF.
Yeah.
Or at least some alternative in addition to PDF. I mean, right now, they're probably, I'm guessing, having not read the news release, that the PDFs are going to look exactly like print, just
sure.
not print.
Right.
If they can have it in a more malleable format, that would be awesome. And also indexed and all that stuff. I guess that's a question. Is there still going to be, if it's not in print, I guess it will still be indexed by the Index to Legal Periodicals and all that fun stuff. That shouldn't change. I hope.
Yeah. I wonder if it's going to have an impact on the how much other scholars are going to use their work or citations to it. Who knows?
Well, this is Ken. This comes as the continuing saga of the implementation of the Durham Statement,
mm-hmm.
adopted in November of 2008.
Right. Are you aware of anybody else either contemplating going this route or?
I'm not aware, but I have. But then again, Duke actually dropped all but their two flagships from print several years ago, shortly after the Durham statement, and they finally. I'm thinking before the news release, Melanie Dunshee, their deputy director, her title now is assistant dean of the law library, not deputy director, had presented a program, a webinar for B Press several weeks ago where she discussed this very fact that they were moving entirely to relying on their digital commons platform.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's interesting.
Go ahead.
Another issue, just to be total Debbie Downer about this. Another issue is that if they're depending entirely on B Press and not their local hosting at all, it's a little scary.
Yeah. Well, and later in the show, we want to spend some time on preservation and Preservation Week. And this kind of raises an issue. I'm going to asterisk this. It seems to me that if you publish on digital format, is there a way that you can, how do you archive it, or how do you back it up? How do you preserve it other than switching it, moving it from platform to platform? And
in anticipation of the discussion, we should note that Clocks is available through Digital Commons. And we'll talk more, I'm sure, later about Clocks.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
It's also available in partnership with LIPA, actually. So
there you go. All right. Yeah. So let's start that and come back to it. I wanted to put in a plug mention the Mirsky Spirit of Law Librarianship Award announcement. A couple of announcements I think have gone out. We're looking for nominees for this year's award. June 1st, I think, is the deadline. If somebody knows a librarian who is volunteering or doing some kind of service to their community, please let me know. We've been doing this now for 24 years, and so we have a lot of we've had a lot of wonderful people nominated and recognized over the years. If you have any questions, let me know. Let's see, another news. Melissa Bernstein is... have you started yet your appointment as a new member of the Depository Library Council?
No, I think we officially start June 1st.
Okay. Well, congratulations. That's pretty neat.
Thank you. I'm very excited.
Now, do you know what you're supposed to be doing in that role or what you will be doing?
Moderately. I can tell you that next week, for anyone who's interested, there is a Depository Library Council virtual meeting, which people can register for online and attend from the safety of your office. It's the 28th through the 30th of April. So I'm hoping that participating in that, I'll get a better idea.
Yeah. Well, I put in the show notes that I think that you should recommend taking over ProQuest Congressional, just nationalizing it.
Yeah, excellent. I'm sure they won't have any objection to that.
ProQuest in particular. I mean, it's all, you know, public information anyway. What the heck?
Yeah.
Let's see. We have coming up, Cali is coming up in June, right?
Yes. I should have the dates memorized. I think it's June 16th through 18th. I should really know that. But yes, in Denver, Colorado at the University of Denver.
Denver's always a wonderful place to visit.
I remember that from my first visit was at AALL in Denver, and it's a really nice town, and we're close to Mass Transit, so the hotel where the people will be staying, so, you know, encouraging people to do a lot more exploration of the city and all that stuff.
Neat. Yeah, and it's
free
at
oxygen
the
tank.
University of Denver.
Please, say that again?
It's at the University of Denver?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
So right. I'm actually looking forward to, you know, with it being, I mean, it's not, it doesn't get too humid here, but I just remember Denver's lovely in the summer, and I know we're doing a lot of outdoor events for the meals and stuff, just to get people out of the building and,
cool.
you know, enjoying the sunshine.
Yeah. And then one thing that sort of popped up on my radar recently that I wanted to just throw out to the group. I haven't heard much more about it, but so one day I went down to the student lounge to get a bag of chips or something, and I saw a student sitting at a table there acting as a student rep for Ravel Law. That sort of surprised me. Is that happening? Any of the other people on the call who are in academic libraries? Ravel Law is got student reps?
This is Ken. We've been contacted by Ravel Law to ask whether we want to sign on to, I'm not sure what exactly to call the process. So they're looking for customers. We haven't signed up yet because we were, by the time we got contacted, we were near the end of our semester. It's a very interesting product, though, not that I've looked at it in depth yet.
Right. Huh. Well, and
yeah,
it's free.
Okay.
Go ahead, Greg.
I was going to say, I had, in fact, I just had lunch, and I'm just getting back from lunch with Corey Bray from Ravel Law, and he mentioned something. I think he said at somewhere between 10 and 15 law schools where they have student reps.
Oh, okay.
So I think USC, it may be a lot on the West Coast, he said one of the things that they're trying to do is to get included on the orientation packet that people see that that's an option outside of Westlaw and Lexis.
Well, so it's interesting that you he's contacted you, or do they have a commercial product?
Oh, yeah. And it hasn't been out very long. Really, there's some amazing things. In fact, I don't know that I've been as excited about new products that are coming out. I don't know, since I worked at the Oklahoma Supreme Court Network in, you know, 12 years ago.
Yeah.
13 years ago. The interesting thing is, and I kind of told this group yesterday, I think, is the Codex, whatever the technology group or project that's coming out of Stanford School.
Yep.
Is just, man, they're really coming up with some cool ideas. I think products like Lex Machina, which is has been out on the market for 2-3 years now. It's an IP analytical tool that goes through and looks at IP dockets and sorts things out on like how long it would normally take to take a certain case to trial, what judges have dealt with it, how they typically ruled on it. It's just a number of things, and the comment I heard from one of the attorneys, we have it here at my firm, and I was telling Corey today, I said, well, if you ever want a librarian just to roll over and buy something, get your attorney to tell him this or her this, is to have the attorney come to them and saying, I am tired of having my, quote, rear end, quote, unquote, handed to me in court because this other firm is using this product and we don't have it.
Yeah.
I guess we'll get that then. Lex Machina has come out of there. Ravelaw is coming out of there. Case Text out of there. If you look up the Codex website there at Stanford, you just have this list of, and I imagine it's probably because there's a lot of VC money floating there, and you know there's a lot of talent both at Stanford and at Silicon Valley for this type of stuff. So, it's really interesting. It's just amazing the stuff that's coming out.
You know, we should have I should plan maybe a show next month where I try to get a lot of these people on. A Case Text is another one that's doing some really exciting things, innovations on legal research, and they're also another one that's there at Stanford. Holly, are you finding at O'Melveny, or are these companies approaching you, or are you working with any of these new startups?
Yeah, I don't know if we're doing anything to assist them, but we're buying some of their products because we have Lex Machina. Actually, I think what's interesting about them, right now it's just IP cases, which is great, but I think they have, and I believe it's public, I think they're working on, I want to say maybe another area of law, but if they can expand outside of that, that's going to be huge because, of course, you know, now I get these questions from other people who come to me from some other department saying, you know, can we do that? Can we slice and dice, you know, labor and employment cases like that? You know, we can't yet, but I have a feeling, you know, that like Greg said, I mean, that information is crucial, especially if, you know, someone else has it and you don't, or someone else can figure that out. So I think that's their market, and I think if they can expand that, they're just going to continue to grow. Some of the others that we've looked at, but I'm not quite sure what the use case is in the firm yet or how helpful it'll be, but I think as they continue to develop, and then, of course, if students are looking at them and then coming into our world, you know, we're going to have to kind of figure out where that fits in.
Yeah.
Yeah, when I was talking with I just happened to be talking with the Case Text people yesterday and the my brain just locked up. But I was talking with Corey today. Where I think we're really kind of looking at technologies that I think are the first step to getting where keyword and Boolean searching will not be the primary way to get to the information.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Corey at Ravel said that, you know, we're looking at maybe 10 years away and maybe faster than that.
Yeah. No, I agree with you 100%, Greg. The in all of the years that I've been a librarian, there's always been talk on and off about how computers were going to replace libraries and everything. And I was very cynical about that. because it seemed to me that all they were doing is digitizing books, you know, and which is fine for photocopying and printing and stuff like that, but didn't really do that much that was different than books or the other tools that we had. But now, in the last few years, really new, different things are happening. I think that we finally got to the point where we're, I think technology's promise is almost going to be realized. And Lex Machina, or however you pronounce it, and Ravel and Haystacks, and some of the neat things that Fastcases is doing as well. It's way different than it was 10 years ago. And it's really cool, I think.
I would say the biggest barrier right now is content. I mean, the big players have the content. They have the access, but they don't have the, I don't know, that startup mentality that, you know, that gee whiz bang interface, a really cool idea. You know, they're kind of stuck supporting, you know, the old interface and content. So you're sitting on this wealth, and, you know, and the access is like, you know, it's like an old hole in the tree, you know, that you got rather than a shiny building. So I hope these guys really get some good content, and can apply all this really cool technology to it.
Yeah. Okay. I think, if I'm not mistaken, Elizabeth Farrell has just joined us.
Yeah, that's me. Sorry to come in late.
Yeah, no,
I don't mean to interrupt.
No. Better late than never.
Mm-hmm.
Good. We're glad to have you.
Thanks.
All right. So does anybody else have any just little newsy things they want to mention before we move on to the main attraction? Oh, the Apple Watch was supposedly available today. This is Apple Watch Day. Anybody on the panel going to be getting one? No?
No.
I don't even wear a regular watch.
But
we're not Beyonce, so we don't get the preferential treatment.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
You should bring June Liebert on the show in a couple weeks and ask her how she likes hers. She's getting one.
Is she getting one?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, we'll have to look and see. That'll be something to watch for.
Well, the big question, yeah, if it's going to be a giveaway at AAOL, that'll be the hot giveaway for a vendor.
Duly noted.
Ah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's definitely going to be a hot commodity. Heck, I'll listen to pitches about products all day.
And I think it was the ABA Tech Show that one of the either vendors or somebody raffled off a drone.
A drone?
Mm-hmm. I think so.
Wow, pretty neat. All right. Well, without any further ado, wanted to Holly Riccio, our president, is a special guest here today, and she wanted to talk to us about a couple of things, and we had a couple of interesting things going on at AAOL. So what's going on at AAOL?
Well, there is a lot going on. First of all, there's this small little event we're going to be holding in Philadelphia in July. I don't know if any of you have heard about it.
Yeah.
The annual meeting is taking place from the 18th to the 21st. So that's kind of the biggest thing that's going on, and a lot of prep going into that right now. Some things I just wanted to highlight on that. One of the things is we have a new app this year for the annual meeting. It's Event Mobi, I believe, is the company, if I'm getting that right. And I know Ken may be able to jump in more with details on the app, but I know some of the things I thought were pretty nice is that you can add things to your schedule, all the AAOL events, meetings, everything that's on there, and then you can export it all to your own Outlook calendar or whatever calendar you're using, because I believe that was a big question from various folks last year. There's also, amongst the other things that you can do, there's also the ability to take notes within the app. So you're at a program, you have a program on your own personal schedule. You can take notes within the app and save them, and then at the very end of the conference, you can email yourself all of the notes, and they're going to come in an email delineated by the program. So it'll have the program name and then your notes, and the next program name and your notes. So, so I thought that was kind of a nice feature as well to, you know, keep things together a little bit more. So those are the two things I personally liked. Ken, actually, do you have anything else you might want to add about the app? Because you saw it too, and we took a look at it.
Chris Siwa, the IT head at the association, demonstrated it for us a few weeks ago. It's actually, and I'm not sure I'm going to get all the terminology right on this, but I would consider it a hybrid app. What it actually does is it runs on the web under HTML5, which allows for the use of the latest designs and back-end scripting. But it creates a shortcut on whatever platform you're using, whether it be iOS, Android, your desktop, so that it's a one-click or a two-click touch, and you get this customized front end that's actually taking the back end from a website, from Event Mobi, and delivering all this functionality to you. So experience is basically identical regardless of the platform you're on.
Right. Yeah, so I think it's pretty nice. So I encourage people to take a look and start adding things to their schedule and playing around with it.
Is it available now?
Yeah, I put the link in.
It is. So if you go on the AALL annual meeting site and click on, I believe it's the either conference schedule or schedule programs or something like that, then there'll be a link there to it, and you can get into it that way.
Yeah.
And you can add your photo and put a little profile up and put all your LinkedIn, Facebook, all your info in there.
And you can also find it in the Apple Store, in the App Store, and on Google Play.
Yeah, Marcia put a link to it in the chat room. So those of you who are listening, click in there.
So,
cool.
Yeah, so that's the first step, right, before we get there.
Yeah.
A couple other things. So Carol Watson, who's the most fabulous AMPC chair ever. And she and I sort of, when we started thinking about the annual meeting and some of the things we wanted to do, you know, kind of put our own personal touch on it and a little different, we've decided that we are separated at professional birth because we had a lot of the same ideas. But a couple of those, one thing we're going to try this year, I know we don't have the Hind Fun Run anymore, so we are actually going to have yoga each morning. So it's going to be in the Marriott, and it'll be, sponsored, and we'll have a person coming in. So it's a little early. It's from 6 to 7, but that gives you enough time to, you know, then go back and do what you need to do to get ready for meetings. But we wanted to just try something different. So we'll see, you know, if people resonate with that and want to do it. If we get, you know, a lot of people doing it, then we can maybe continue that in future years. But that's something we're just kind of trying. So we'll see how that goes. Another thing that I wanted to try, I had talked with Frank Hodek, who's the chair of the AALL Awards Committee, about trying to share the knowledge, expertise, inspiration from our highest award winners, the Gallagher Award winners, more widely with everybody. You know, they get to speak at the luncheon, but that's kind of a brief, very brief speech. It's more to thank people and kind of make a little personal comment. But we wanted to do something a little different. So on Sunday, from 5:15 to 6:15, we're going to be doing something we're calling the Gallagher Up Close and Personal. And so Frank is going to be kind of having an informal conversation with the recipients for this year. So I encourage people to drop by and try to, you know, especially younger and newer librarians who may not have a sense of who some of these people are, you know, to really get a sense and kind of learn and be inspired by them. So I'm hoping that is successful. So we're trying that. That's new as well.
Who are the winners this year?
I don't believe that has come out yet, so I'm not at liberty to say, but that will be out very shortly.
Right. Okay.
I
hadn't heard yet.
No, they're still getting all that together, but that's before we before we even knew who they were, we definitely wanted to do that event. So, I encourage people to come to that, or, you know, to, when you talk to people, especially, again, people who may not know who some of these folks are, I think that's a good opportunity. The other thing we're doing is we bumped up how many programs per slot a little bit. So we have 8 programs per slot, just to add a little more variety, make sure there's something for everybody, hopefully, in each slot. So we wanted to do that. And then we are also having the Law Librarian Conversations, of the live AALL Philly edition. So we're going to be doing that each day. so it kind of has a two-prong purpose. I mean, obviously, I think it'll be interesting for people to stop by at the end of the day, share things, you know, and have some conversations. But for those who unfortunately may not be able to go to the meeting, you know, hopefully there's a very, very small number of those. But for the folks that can't, or for folks that, you know, are in other areas that are just really interested in what's going on there, you know, they'll be able to listen to that live, you know, if, even if they're not in Philly. So, so I encourage people to stop by and share things, or bring speakers, or bring interesting folks by there, and we're just going to kind of see how that works out. So those were some of the kind of the different things that we sort of thought we would try.
And if I may just sort of add to your comment before somebody gets the wrong idea, when you say, you know, bring interesting people by, we'd like them to be affiliated with law librarianship in the conference.
I'm sorry. I don't want you to pick people up off the street.
It's, you know, there's always that possibility. So.
Like if you're moderating a panel and have a speaker, or you have a VIP guest or something like that. Yeah, no, I should have clarified.
No, I'm kidding. Good.
I don't want to stick you with I don't know what, you know, but you guys would make the best of it, I'm sure. So maybe we get a convert. Right. We get, you know, a member out of it or something. You never know. And then of course the very exciting keynote speaker, which is actually why I may have to drop off this call a little early, because I have a call right afterwards with her. I'm super excited that Terry Gross is going to be our keynote speaker. So she's going to be sharing some of her experiences as an interviewer, the good, the bad, you know, what she's learned from things and kind of her insight. And so I think that fits in really well with the theme of connecting and kind of, you know, developing those kind of relationships. And you know, she's able to ask these questions and get people to share things, you know, it's almost seamlessly, but obviously it doesn't happen that way. And so, and she's also very, very fond of, I know, librarians and research. She does, you know, a lot of research on her, the people that she interviews. And I know that they routinely give on-air credit to their librarian at NPR. So, so I'm really excited about that, too. So that's another thing that is coming up. So that's kind of, those are the things I wanted to highlight about the annual meeting. I mean, if anybody has specific questions, or other, anybody on the panel want to add anything else.
I'm looking forward to it. I love Philadelphia. There are so many neat historical kinds of things to do. So much great food, and it's a wonderful place for a conference. And for everything I've seen, it's going to be a lot of really rich programming. So that'll be fun.
Yeah, we've got a lot of good programs, a lot of outside speakers. I should also note that the luncheon, the AAL luncheon speaker will be why am I blanking? Ross Davies from the Green Bag, also known as one of the bobblehead guys. So he will be our luncheon speaker, and I can't make any promises, but there may be some Supreme Court bobblehead giveaway opportunities. Still working on that one, but we'll see. But he's going to be the speaker there, in addition to the Gallagher Award winners. So
neat.
So the other thing I was going to share about was the ABA. There's some, the ABA Innovation Summit on the Future of Legal Services. So the ABA president, a while back, William Hubbard, established a commission on the future of legal services. And when they were established, they asked for various stakeholders and constituents to share comments based on a position paper that they had put out. And so we submitted comments from AALL, mostly around access to justice issues and places where, you know, we feel that we can add some value and you know, partner more with the ABA and other entities in that arena. So we submitted our written comments, and then they decided that they were going to have a hearing at their mid-year meeting, which was in Houston in February. I think it was early February. And so I went ahead and attended that and testified in person and shared kind of a portion of our comments in a five-minute distilled version. And let me tell you, 5 minutes goes by really fast.
Yeah.
tried to get it all in. And so we shared that, and there were a bunch of other people there, the CEO of LegalZoom, one of the guys from Avvo, various other people that are involved in access to justice issues, some state court judges, various other constituents. So it was very interesting not only to have the opportunity to present that information to the committee, but also just to listen to the other folks that were in the room. And then after this hearing, they decided that they were going to put on this Innovation Summit. And so it's an invitation-only event, and so AALL was invited to participate. So it's going to be May 2nd to the 4th at Stanford Law School. So I'm going to go ahead and attend that on behalf of AALL. And I can't get the live chat to work, but I did send someone a link, so hopefully somebody will post the link. But they do have their agenda up on their website. I won't go through it all, but I think it's going to be really interesting. I mean, there's a lot of opportunity for kind of breakout groups and having these discussions. I think at the very end they're going to have some reaction panels and people that are going to be reporting out from the groups. So I'm really hopeful that, you know, that we can make some good connections and partnerships and see what kind of opportunities there are with AALL and the ABA in terms of the access to justice issues. Some of the speakers, Andrew Perlman from Suffolk, who's actually the co-chair of the commission, Richard Susskind, who we all know is a past AALL keynote, and Monica Bay, who used to be with Law Technology News, and she's listed as a fellow at Codex, so because I know she retired from Law Technology News, but I guess she's involved with Codex now. So I'm really excited about that. So I'm excited about that both from the AALL angle and also, frankly, from my law firm angle and kind of what, you know, what they're going to be talking about. So it sounds really exciting. So I'm looking forward to attending and then obviously being able to report back and kind of share, you know, what that means for AALL and what kind of opportunities we can build on.
Very neat. Is
Is anyone else from?
On the panel here.
Probably okay. Not.
Yeah.
I think it's a lot of the people that ended up testifying there, and actually some of the people that testified are also speaking too, on various issues. So,
Do you happen to know if they're broadcasting it in any way, or?
It doesn't say, so I'm not sure. I would guess, if anything, maybe some of the speakers would, but then there's a lot of this kind of breakout stuff, so it could get kind of funky. I'm not sure, but I'll actually take a look. I have some other communications from them to see what they're doing, because I know there's a plenary session. There's some kind of, you know, bigger things, but I'm not sure what they're set up for there at the law school. So,
Well, like Greg said, a lot of innovation and a lot of interesting thinking is going on these days at Stanford when it comes to technology and law and law practice and things. This could be very exciting.
Actually, the day before that, they're doing their annual Codex Future of Law Conference, because that one I'm going to. And that's open to anyone. It's not invite only, so I'm going to that one. But
is that on the
I
first?
Or? Connected anyway or please?
It's April 30th.
Oh, April 30th.
Yeah,
okay.
April 30th. And I guess I'm looking at my, I'm bad with dates today, clearly. in the same week. You know?
Yeah.
No, that's great.
Huh.
Yeah, so it means the good and the bad, right? It's in my backyard, so it's pretty easy. I don't get to go to the Canadian Association this year because it overlaps, but I'm going to switch with Steve Anderson, so he's going to attend the Canadian Association this year, and then I can go the following year. So we made everything work out because this seemed like a really great opportunity, and we didn't want to pass it up. So.
Yeah. Well, have fun. I can't wait to hear how it goes.
Yeah, I will. I will try to tweet or something. Sometimes I'm not real good at that, especially when I'm in it. But I'll try to. I'll try to do something. And I'm sure they have. I think they already have hashtags that they've identified. I think those are on their website too, so you can follow those as the as those days go on. Because
okay.
I know on Saturday and Sunday everybody's really going to want to follow this, but
yeah.
It's on a weekend. But still, so. And then
well,
the only other thing I really wanted to, I'm really, really excited about is the AOL rebranding initiative. So this was mentioned in, I think we had a communication that went out from me that talked about a lot of different things that the board and the association have been looking at coming out of our fall retreat where we kind of threw a lot of stuff on the table and really looked at, you know, how being strategic about what we're doing. And so we have engaged a company called Mission Minded. They're, I think their home base is actually out here in the Bay Area, but their folks are all over. And, in fact, the fact that two people that are working with us, I believe, are based out of Denver, Colorado. And they work primarily or almost specifically with nonprofits. So they don't work with big corporations around branding. They really focus on the nonprofit world. So that I thought was is really important and I think really will be beneficial to us as we move through this. So when we had the board meeting in Chicago a couple weeks ago, before we had the board meeting, we had a day where we just met with them and kind of did a lot of brainstorming and activities around our brand, around AALL, trying to, you know, kind of talk about, you know, where we're going, where do we see ourselves, what has changed, you know, what do we represent, where do we want the profession to move. So we did a lot of exercises around that. The two women that were there really have done their homework. They've actually, prior to that meeting, had already interviewed quite a few of our members to talk to them about, you know, what they think of the association, what it means to them, other thoughts about branding with other associations and all kinds of things like that. So they did their homework and had a lot of information. They really kind of know who we are. So I think that's great, too. Of course, they were impressed with us because they said, you know, usually they don't go into an association and are presented with not only an official historian but a 24-page document on the association's history. So,
yeah.
You know, of course, we're librarians, right? So, of course, we're going to have that. But they were notably impressed by that.
Is part of this process of rebranding is the name of the profession or the name of the association also in play, or
that will be part of the discussion? Yes. So it's
okay.
They're going to look at everything. They're going to look at. I mean, and it doesn't mean it's going to change or it's not going to change. There's really, you know, no guarantee one way or the other. But they're going to look at the name. They're looking at our logo. They're looking at our tagline. You know, they'll leave. You know, they do stuff around colors and looks and, you know, all kinds of stuff. So it's a completely comprehensive project.
Okay.
Now the National Association for Legal Placement used them recently, and they actually only had them do their, I believe it was their logo, and they Kate Hagen, I believe, talked to somebody there, and they said they actually wished they had done more. They wished they had gone further and done more than just the logo, but done kind of a more comprehensive package. So that's what we're doing. The next steps, we're going to get some. They're kind of. You know, they said they take everything that they learned from us during that day and, you know, they go back and, you know, that's where, you know, the sausage gets made. They have arguments about, you know, very specific words and what things mean and what they think would be best. And they do a lot of work on their end. And then they're going to come back with some more information for the board to look at that kind of distills a lot of what they talk about. And then at some point, I assume after the summer, we will be asking all members to give their opinions and thoughts on this, because the point really is to get everybody to have a discussion around this whole topic and kind of share things. I mean, a lot of, you know, PLL has now changed their name. The SCCLL has changed their name. You know, so a lot of, you know, SLA talked about this years ago. You know, it's definitely been a topic of interest. And so I think it's kind of the right time for us to really look at this and see where we're going to position ourselves for future success. So I'm looking forward to kind of seeing what happens with it. I think the group we're working with is fantastic. And I really want to encourage everybody, you know, I'll do it on this call and I'll try to do it as much as I can, you know, when we ask members to participate and share their thoughts, to please do so. Because the only way we can really get to, you know, kind of, you know, the best, the right answer, the place that we should all be is if everybody weighs in. So I really encourage everybody to share their thoughts when we reach out and give that opportunity. I don't know, Ken, actually Ken and Emily, I think we're both there, so I don't know if either of you have anything you want to add from that session.
I think you've described it quite accurately, and I would only not add, but reiterate for anyone listening that the goal is to get wide participation from the membership in as far as getting input.
Yeah, and I should also add that in this meeting, we'll have another one in the summer, I believe another one with the fall board meeting, that we also have representatives from the three different library type SISs. So we have someone from PLL, SCCLL, and the academics. I mean, it's going to be the same person at each meeting to provide some consistency and to have that voice as well. So we wanted to make sure that we had that those folks in the room to really kind of help us with this. So we've tried to get everybody involved from the start.
Pretty fun.
Yeah, exciting stuff. I personally like it because I think probably if I wasn't a librarian, I would be in some sort of like marketing thing where you're thinking about taglines and logos and all the words and all that kind of nuanced stuff. I have an affinity for that, so that's probably why it's a little more exciting to me. But I think it is really exciting in general. And actually, I think SLA is sort of doing something. You know, they went through that whole proposed name change thing quite a few years ago, but they're so they're not changing their name, but they are doing some kind of, what are they calling it? There was something on their website or on the Southern California's section of SLA. They called it a consultant's update, and it sounds like they're sort of looking at, you know, the definition of what SLA is all about, you know, kind of the framework for them. So it's interesting that, you know, that it's kind of more than just our association as well. I think there's other library and law associations that are sort of looking at where they sit, you know, and where things, now that things have changed, kind of where their market is and where they want to position themselves.
Yeah, I think that over the years, from my perspective, I was teasing you before, leading up to the show, when I saw that on your list of things to talk about. Oh no, here we go again. It seems like every few years we sort of dip back into that and wonder who we are, and you know, and I really was teasing, because it is something that's important to do, even if we are, you know, as individuals or, you know, as a group, are real confident about what we do, and I think we do a heck of a good job for the most part. It still is helpful to step back, you know, and sort of figure out where, you know, what we're doing, where we're going, and making sure that we're, you know, keeping up with the world as it changes around us and as expectations for us do. So this is good. It'll be fun.
Yeah.
It looks like the whole process will take about a year.
Yeah, I think it's 18 months total. So like, yeah, about a year and a half. So it will go on. It will go on after I pass the gavel and continue, and the next president will kind of see it to fruition.
Yeah.
Whatever it ends up being.
Well, very good. Does anybody have any questions of Holly about what she's doing and the rest of your administration? You still have a couple of months to go, right?
Yeah, I'm in the home stretch. I feel like the first half, like maybe through December or January, seemed kind of, I don't know, normal or kind of regular. And then I think after January, it just kind of shot off like a rocket, and it's been really very busy. I mean, part of that is, you know, we talked a lot about a lot of things at the board meeting in the fall, and so there were a lot of kind of initiatives or things we wanted to do or special committees to look at stuff. So there was a lot of change happening, which I think was part of it. But it's
yeah.
It's a lot. I think I have one more column to write. I'm on the countdown there. I've got one more to write to get in for Spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody asked me the other day. They said, would you do it again? And I said, I absolutely would. I think it's a once in a lifetime experience.
So when it's all over, what are you going to miss the most?
Honestly, as much as I get a lot of emails and I'm bombarded with a lot of information, I think it's that kind of, that constant connection. Kate Hagen and I have a weekly call and we talk about all the things that are going on. And you get really in it. I'm totally in it, and it's always kind of in my head, and it's on my list of to-dos, things that are kind of going on. And I think that as much as it'll be nice to kind of step away a little bit and maybe refocus my energies, I think it's always hard when you just sort of, you're kind of done with something and you kind of change the way you interact with the association. So that and racking up frequent flyer miles, but...
That's right.
although United changed the way they do their miles, so it's actually probably good I got most of my miles before they made the change, because now I'm not getting as many. But
yeah,
that's neither here nor there.
How that stuff happens. Once, many years ago, it just so happened I had to attend 3 different conferences, and I was interviewing for a job during a 3-month period where United had this special triple miles deal. In 6 months I ended up with so many miles I was, they were treating me like royalty. But it didn't last. It did not last.
Yeah. I will also say
fun while it did, I tell you.
Yeah. I will also say, obviously, as I'm still a member of the board, so I'll get to do continue to do chapter visits in the following year, but just having come back from the SEAL conference, I think that's one of the most exciting things is, going to visit different chapters or different associations for their meetings and kind of, really getting to talk to a lot of people. I like calling people on the phone and, asking them to be a part of things, especially when people say yes and they're really excited about it. So just having that, kind of interaction has been really, really great for me, too.
Yeah. Well, very good. What is our time? Okay. Well, thank you very much, Holly, for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was really fun. And hope to have you, back as a regular contributor at some point. So,
I would love to. I may not have all the inside scoop still, but I'll try to share what I can.
But we have lots of fun on the podcast, and none of us has the inside scoop or little bits and pieces. So that's part of what it's all about. Well, let's turn our attention to our government relations people. Sorry to keep you both waiting patiently to give us your update. What's happening in the world of government and as it relates to what we do?
Hey, Rich. This is Emily Feltrin, Director of Government Relations for AAWL, and I have Elizabeth Holland, who's our Public Policy Associate. Thanks so much for having us on today.
Yeah. You're welcome.
Just a side note that you, of course, and Melissa Bernstein are both members of AAWL's Government Relations Committee as well. So you're, in the thick of a lot of these issues, too, which is really fun.
Yeah.
So there actually is a lot going on. You might not think so if you read headlines sometimes about Congress. But this week in particular, we've actually been quite busy. So I'm going to kick it off talking about a few things, and feel free to interrupt me, and then I'll hand it over to Elizabeth to talk about net neutrality and privacy and a couple other things. So I'm going to start with sort of the breaking news item. which is that this week the House Appropriations Subcommittee that deals with funding for GPO, the Government Publishing Office, and the Library of Congress, met and had a markup yesterday, which means they took a look at their draft bill and were preparing to vote on it. The draft bill is actually really quite disappointing in that it provides $10 million less for GPO than was in their proposed budget, which the GPO had requested flat funding for 2016. They had requested $120 million. And the way that the funding was cut was just to totally take out the line item for the revolving fund. Now, what the revolving fund is, it's their business operations fund. So GPO does get money back into that fund from government agencies, which they then use to support their programs. But they also ask for funding for that program because they very desperately need it in order to support some of their infrastructure projects, which includes their IT projects, supporting FedSys, developing FedSys, their enterprise systems internally, and then also just facilities upgrades. For those of you who have been to GPO's building, it is old and it is creaky, and the elevators, you might not want to get stuck in for too long, and the roof can be leaky, and all these other things. So, of course, you know, we're focused mainly on the government information aspect of it and are particularly concerned that the House bill right now, as it stands, completely wipes out funding for the revolving fund. This doesn't mean FedSys would disappear, but it certainly means that the upgrades that GPO is planning for FedSys, they're in the process of getting ready, sort of working through a beta new FedSys website that they'd like to launch soon. They won't be able to get as far with that as they would have liked. They won't be able to add content and new collections to FedSys and work on some issues related to access and accessibility and discovery of information. So it's actually pretty troubling. This is not the first time that the House in particular has eliminated this line item, but it is particularly troubling, especially this year, because GPO really made an effort to keep their funding requests quite reasonable. As I said, they were asking for flat funding, so they weren't really requesting any additional funds this year, and that's after, you know, their funds have been cut quite substantially in the last several years. So it's really a big blow. For those of you who might want to check out the hearing or the draft, you can go to appropriations.house.gov. Ranking member of the subcommittee, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, spoke quite eloquently about the need for funding for the revolving fund, talking about how if funding were cut, it could actually put at risk the free access that the public now has to FedSys, which would really be unacceptable on many different levels.
I ask you a kind of a stupid question here? But why is it called? What is it called? A revolving fund?
Yeah, so it's called their business operations revolving fund because money does go in and out of it. It is used to support printing for federal agencies, and then when federal agencies pay GPO back for printing, it goes back into the revolving fund. I noted, that's not the funding that supports these additional projects like the FedSys project and facilities repairs and things like that.
But it seems like if it's money that is transactional between them and, you know, customers of all stripes, whether they're other government offices or, you know, the public or whoever, it seems to me that government should keep their fingers out of it altogether.
Yeah, well, there's the funds that are sort of the revolving funds, which are those going in and out. But in addition, they add and they request this pretty limited amount of money. So this year it's $10 million from Congress to fund specific projects. So that money would not be part of the money that's going in and out. That would be going to FedSys development or building upgrades and things like that.
Oh, okay.
Also, with the revolving fund, it's not something that's limited to a fiscal year. That money can go beyond the year.
Right. That's true, too. Thanks, Greg.
Oh, okay.
So where things stand right now, the Appropriations Committee hasn't yet voted on this bill, but it is in committee. So I have been encouraging this week members, AALL and chapter members, to contact their members of Congress, particularly if they serve on the House Appropriations Committee, to ask them to support funding for the revolving fund and to support putting that money back in so that GPO can continue to develop FedSys. We have an action alert that I think Marcia put into the chat box. That action alert also goes to a general alert supporting both GPO and Library of Congress funding. You can certainly, if your member is not a member of the House Appropriations Committee, you can certainly contact your member as well as your senators because, of course, the Senate Appropriations will be considering an alleged branch bill as well. Right now, as I said, we're focusing on House Appropriations, but we, you know, welcome your messages. If you are willing to send a message to your member of Congress, one of the things to keep in mind is that it's really best and you have the best chance of being heard and read if you personalize those messages. So while we do offer on our action site some sample messages, we encourage you to edit those messages with your own thoughts about why FedSys and GPO is so important to you, how it helps your work and helps your library users and things like that.
And anybody listening, either live or afterwards, if you take that step, be forewarned. And don't be surprised if you don't get a phone call back or a letter back. Maybe it's usually going to be just a staff member from your congressman or senator's office, but they do read these things. First time I did it, I was surprised to hear from the chief of staff asking questions about my letter and about why I was concerned. So encouraged to do it, and keep in mind that they do get read and do get listened to.
Yeah, thanks for that, Rich. And the other thing is, even if you don't receive a response right away, or maybe you receive a less than inspiring response, it might be something that looks like it was sort of a general response. Your letters are being tallied by the staff, and that means, so your letter in support of GPO funding will go to that appropriate staffer, and it'll be marked as a constituent in support of greater funding for GPO and that type of thing. So certainly your messages are important.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I don't want to take up all the time here. We have a lot we could potentially discuss.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to go over UALMA really quickly because most of our resources are already on ALLNET. The Uniform Electronic Legal Material Act is moving through the legislative process. This session, bills are still pending in Massachusetts, New York, and Texas, and we have some promising movement in all three of those states. We also still have time in some states for potential introductions, and I've been working closely with some AALL members and chapter members to encourage introduction of UALMA in a couple of states. And I wanted to put in a plug for an upcoming training that Elizabeth and I will be doing on Wednesday, May 13th. Which is a free training for AALL members and chapter members on UALMA advocacy. And we'll be talking about best practices and challenges and how to work towards success and ultimate enactment of UALMA in your state. There's a link I can put in the chat box for signing up for that training. So if you're a AALL or chapter member, I'd encourage you to do that. It's just a 30-minute training. During the East Coast lunch hour from 12 to 12:30 East Coast time. So I hope to see many of you there as well. I think at this point I'm going to turn it over to my colleague Elizabeth to talk about a couple other issues that AALL is working on right now.
Sure. Thanks, Emily. Hi, everyone. This is Elizabeth Holland. I'm the Public Policy Associate in AALL's Government Relations Office here in D.C., and as Emily mentioned, it has been a busy week legislatively here in D.C., so I just wanted to touch on a couple of issues that have been coming up and are of interest to law librarianship, the first of which is sort of a topic du jour of late, and that's net neutrality. So hopefully by now you've heard and celebrated the good news that net neutrality, which is the principle that all internet traffic is treated equally, is now the law of the land. That's great news that is in result of the Open Internet Order that was adopted by the Federal Communications Commission, or FCC, in mid-February this year. And that Open Internet Order made it so that internet service providers cannot unfairly speed up, slow down, or block some websites over others. We've been celebrating the good news, but of course it is not without challenge, both legislative and legal, particularly of late. As expected, the internet and wireless service providers have filed lawsuits. To date, I believe there are 6 lawsuits that challenge the authority that the FCC used in enacting their Open Internet Order to protect network neutrality. They regulated internet service using the same legal tool that was originally written for legacy phone companies. That's Title II of the Telecommunications Act of 1934. So we will continue to see these challenges play out in the courts. And at the same time, many congressional Republicans have come out in opposition to net neutrality. So whether that has something more to do with the president's support for it or where they get their campaign donations, perhaps more than real policy, we think. You may have seen that the FCC chairman, Tom Wheeler, has really been given a shellacking on the Hill. He's been visiting, making the rounds at congressional hearings. I think he spoke at 5 different hearings in March and really feeling the brunt of the Republican Party. Legislatively this week, there's been some movement to try and curb those FCC rules. Republican reps Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee and Doug Collins of Georgia both introduced measures last week that would set aside the FCC's ruling on net neutrality. Rep. Blackburn's bill is H.R. 1212, the Internet Freedom Act, and in her words, that would block the FCC's net neutrality rules by stating that they shall have no force and no effect, and it would also prohibit the FCC from reissuing any net neutrality rules.
Okay.
Similarly, Representative Collins' bill is a resolution of disapproval, which states that the House disapproves, or the Senate actually, the House disapproves of net neutrality and that those rules would have no enforcement, but he's inciting it under the Congressional Review Act, which would mean that it would only need a simple Senate majority to pass under the procedural rules of the Congressional Review Act. So clearly political moves to curb this net neutrality new law of the land from continuing forward. There were also 3 members of the House Energy and Commerce Committee this week that floated transparency-related bills that have more to do with the process by which the FCC adopted its Open Internet Order, but again, more political posturing on this issue. That's all to say that if somehow, some way, any of this legislation passed through both chambers, which seems very unlikely, there's really no chance that President Obama would do anything but veto it and send it back to Congress. And it would certainly lack the supermajority support it would need to override a presidential veto. So we don't see that these legislative threats have much staying power. As I said, there's really more to do with political posturing than it does a real legislative fix.
Yeah. And as we were talking about it on the Government Relations Committee and this Government Review Act popped up,
mm-hmm.
For people who are listening, it's worth looking up and reading about the history of the act. It's a relatively new piece of legislation that was passed by, I don't know, whatever the party was that was disgruntled in the mid-90s about what was the executive office was doing. And it's kind of a fast track to disapprove federal regulations. It's never really been successful, but it's an interesting act
that
I've never heard of.
What? Procedural gimmickry happening recently.
Yeah.
I'll talk about another procedural gimmick that's being invoked in the Senate on another privacy-related issue in just a minute. But all that to say about net neutrality legislation, while we do not support these political efforts by the Republican Party to curb the Open Internet Order, AAAL would certainly support a legislative solution that would codify net neutrality in law. As you all know well, law librarians rely on net neutrality to really fulfill your duty to provide non-discriminatory access to online legal content. You know, net neutrality is what ensures that equal access to the Internet is available for all patrons and allows them a consistent and reliable way of accessing information online. So a legislative fix that would give, you know, more firm legal footing to this principle is something we would definitely support and hope to see in the future. And then two other issues related to privacy came up this week, specifically patron privacy as we think of it, that are worth mentioning. First, in the interest of time, I'll just quickly touch on two information sharing cybersecurity bills that were passed by the House this week. One is the Protecting Cyber Networks Act, PCNA, H.R. 1560. The other is the National Cybersecurity Protection Advancement Act of 2015, H.R. 1731. Both passed this week in the House by a good margin on Wednesday and Thursday, although neither we feel is particularly good on the privacy or the transparency front. As we have in the past with cybersecurity threat sharing bills, we are opposing both bills because we feel that they would enable unnecessarily overbroad sharing of personal information to intelligence agencies without adequate protections of privacy. They also would expand the use of FOIA exemptions. Neither of these bills would create a new FOIA exemption, although the bill that the Senate is considering would do so. But that obviously gets into some murky territory when it comes to transparency and good government. But you can read more about our take on this legislation on our Washington blog. We just did a write-up of both bills, including a coalition letter we signed in opposition to H.R. 1560. So those bills will move to the Senate, although, as I said, the Senate is considering their own cybersecurity bill. And it looks like the Senate is hoping to vote on that before Memorial Day. So certainly an issue that we'll be keeping an eye on in the coming weeks. And then perhaps of some more interest on the privacy front, there was legislation introduced this week that would cleanly reauthorize Section 215 of the Patriot Act, which is set to expire on June 1st of this year otherwise. The bill number is S-1035, and it would reauthorize this provision without amendment through the year 2020, so for another 5 years. And, of course, Section 215, we've learned in really only the last 2 years, is what has been used to justify the NSA's full collection of Americans' telephone records. This bill, yeah, troublingly, was introduced by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell of the Republican Kentucky. And as I was saying before, he also invoked a Senate procedural gimmick called Rule 14 that would give the bill a fast track straight to the Senate floor and bypass any committee consideration, which is never good news to hear.
Yeah.
Obviously, AAAL strongly opposes S-1035. You know, we feel and we have felt since the Patriot Act was first enacted in 2001 that Section 215 really needs reform to better protect patron privacy. Section 215, of course, is what's been known as the library records provision because it allows the government to seize a wide range of documents, including library records, under the definition of any tangible item. The glimmer of hope is that we are expecting to see reform legislation for 215 introduced next week in both the House and Senate. It looks like the House will probably move quickly on it as well. That will be a version of the USA Freedom Act, which AAAL supported in the last Congress and which passed the House and then failed only by a very narrow margin, a procedural vote in the Senate at the very end of last Congress. So we'll be looking for that and calling on you all to take action in support of USA Freedom and to oppose S-1035, the McConnell clean reauthorization. It's possible that this bill that was just introduced is just sort of a backup plan should negotiations fail before the June 1st expiration date of Section 215. But either way, you know, we're wary to see such a straight and narrow reauthorization of this mass surveillance authority by the Senate Majority Leader. So we will be tracking that issue closely and calling for your help soon.
Wow. Yeah, there is a lot of stuff happening.
It's been busy, despite all you hear about D.C.
Yeah.
Getting it all done now that the Easter Passover recess is over and they're actually in town for a few weeks.
Boy, and the privacy issue is one, in a lot of ways, I think you only, you know, touched on a couple of the important issues. There are so many other initiatives that are out there, legislation that's pending and proposed regulations that'll affect, you know, students and health records and all kinds of other stuff. It's really getting scary. Well, thank you very much for all this gloomy news.
I wish I had something better to report.
Yeah, well, you're doing a good job for us. And, you know, I want to encourage everybody to you know, come to, like, the advocacy training that's offered at AALL and a number of other programs that you do. Don't you do an update at the annual meeting and some other...
Especially at the beginning of the meeting here. So, as you said, thank you. The Legislative Advocacy Training will take place on Saturday, July 18th, from 8:30 a.m. to 12 p.m., and you can register free of charge as you're registering for AALL, the conference. Emily just sent out the registration link, so I hope you'll attend, and that's something where we focus not only on our legislative priorities and successes of the last year, but also the skills needed to be involved in our advocacy work. This year we're focusing on relationships with lawmakers and legislators. And then the public policy update will be Sunday, July 19th from 4 to 5 p.m. Is that correct? I believe so. 4 to 5 p.m. Eastern in Philly. And you'll hear about the great work that the GRC members, including Rich and Melissa, have been up to this year, as well as the work of our Copyright Committee and our Digital Access to Legal Information Committee, in sort of a small roundtable format where you can talk more candidly with the committee chairs. So it's a great way to stay sort of abreast of everything we've been doing and everything we will be doing in the years to come, and, of course, where your effort is needed to help support us. So I certainly encourage you to attend if you'll be in Philadelphia.
And, you know, things are moving so quickly with legislation and the way technology is facilitating a lot of change that I think it's, in a lot of ways, more important than ever for all of us to be aware of what's going on out there that might affect us and, you know, as a result, get involved and try to do something. Well, thank you very much for that update again.
You're welcome.
Do you have any more that you'd like to throw at us before we move on to our
Well, I know you asked me to just give a quick update on PACER, so I'll just do that in about 30 seconds.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
Which is that after the fall disappearance of docket and other information from PACER debacle that we all remember well in August and September, members of Congress did not take kindly, and actually that raised a lot of eyebrows on Capitol Hill about what was going on with the administrative office and PACER. But come spring 2015, that issue has not gone away. And members of Congress are still working to bring some more transparency to the administrative office and try to increase accountability at the AO along with PACER. So I just wanted to give a quick 10 seconds to let you all know that AALL is working with several congressional offices, including Chairman Grassley and Senator Leahy, on this issue, and it is ongoing and I think is an issue that will see more attention in the coming months as well.
Well, thank you very much. Okay, let's shift gears a little bit. I should let everybody know we're going to, this is another topic that we're not going to be able to, the whole issue of preservation and what does it mean that we're going to be able to do everything that we wanted. We had a couple of people that we wanted to invite on the panel who we weren't able to get a hold of, and so that's why we're part of why we're saving it to the end. And in 10 minutes, I'm not sure we'll be able to do it much justice other than to just mention some issues. But it is something that won't go away, and so we'll revisit on a later podcast, perhaps in Philadelphia. So Melissa and Elizabeth are sort of our resident experts on preservation. What is Preservation Week, and what is it mean? What does it mean? What are we talking about? Anybody
want to stab at it? I don't. I think calling myself an expert's too far. But Melissa, do you want to take this?
Well, I can tell you what Preservation Week is because I pulled it up, being a good librarian on the AMA website.
There you go.
And apparently, it was started in about 2010 by ALA, specifically the Association for Library Collections and Technical Services. They started this with a bunch of national partners, and it was really to draw attention after the results of a survey that they did that at the time, the survey was done, it says, in 2004, and it showed that about 1.3 billion items needed treatment to reduce the rate of risk and damage. And so it's basically just drawing attention to the need for preservation of different types of resources, mostly held, I guess, in libraries. But so that's kind of how it all started.
To which I would, well, I mean, so when I hear that, and I'm familiar with those issues, I just, whenever I hear preservation, I keep thinking of, you know, improving book bindings and archival paper and things like that. And then, you know, for a while there, in fact, I think that's how LLMC ended up becoming, you know, the reason that it formed was to make archival microform copies of materials that were in danger of being corroded or disintegrating.
They also mention that several libraries just have no staff or money at all for, let's say, collection maintenance or collection upkeep, and some of the environmental factors that you mentioned, like light, pollutants, moisture, mm-hmm. Heat, and excessive dryness. You know, there's so there are several factors that contribute. Mm-hmm. But I guess, you know, we also look at it more broadly in addition to materials that can deteriorate. We also have materials that maybe there's only one copy left and it's in danger of being, you know, something ever happens to it, you know, there it goes. So it just draws attention to the need for preservation more widely.
Yeah.
And I'd agree, and I think that, and not to derail the intentions of Preservation Week, but I think that, you know, the important piece of this, too, that should be, I think, almost equally emphasized is the access, and I think that's where we kind of get digitization in there, because, I mean, it's great to preserve things, and then we should be, especially last copies, special collections, but, you know, we don't want to get to the point where, you know, preservation, people think of preservation and it ends up being like that scene from the end of Indiana Jones and the Lost Ark where it's
yeah.
the warehouse in boxes. Yeah. You know, we want to make sure that, you know, this stuff is accessible. And I think that also helps libraries, their mission and, you know, improving relationships with stakeholders and patrons when we can take this information, or these materials, and make them accessible. And usually, especially now, and especially in law libraries, that means digitization. And, you know, whether it's special collections, primary legal materials, you know, or all the just different ephemera and materials that we all have.
And I guess to that end, one of the reasons that I'm here today is as a representative of LIPA, and our executive director is sorry that she couldn't be here today. But just to kind of highlight some of the activities that LIPA is working on and has been working on, one is the Palm Print Project. That's for the primary legal materials in print.
We're currently completing our second year of the three-year pilot and have ingested over 60,000 volumes. They're currently working on filling the gaps in that collection and also trying to determine what its future will be. We've held our first successful webinar this year, which was in February. It was called Digitization is Possible, and there is a recording and a toolkit that came out of that webinar, both of which are available on the LIPA website. And that also helps identify some resources for digitization and some of the standards and best practices for that. Along the lines of what I guess Elizabeth was just saying, LIPA co-sponsored the Law Repositories Conference last month and also presented a debate on digital preservation there, which I guess we're hoping to possibly recreate on the podcast. That was called Is Digitization Preservation? And debated sort of whether it is or isn't. And we have a program coming up at AALL in Philly called Quality Digitization Projects on a Budget. One thing to look for next week is that we are about to launch a survey of digitization projects that various libraries are working on. This is the product of the LIPA Content Registry Task Force, which I guess was following up on a study which had been done in 2005. So be on the lookout for that, and we'll ask anyone who has a digital project underway to complete that. We also offer web archiving through an Archive-It consortial discount. And as I'm sorry, I'm just blanking on the name right now. Ken. As Ken mentioned, we do have a law review preservation program in partnership with BPress and Clocks, which I think Ken mentioned before. And if folks have heard of PERMA-CC, LIPA is a supporting partner of PERMA, which is a web archiving tool which helps with link rot. So we have a lot of things going on. I would encourage your library to become a member if it isn't already and to check out our resources on the LIPA website. So thank you for letting me take some time to get up on my soapbox there.
Good job. You covered almost everything there.
Covered it all in a short period of time. That was
hey,
my plan.
So
I'm gonna
what Clocks, can you what does Clocks mean?
I think Ken might be better for that one if he's still with us.
I'm still with you. I'd have to look up the C part of it. Lock stands for lots of copies, keep stuff safe.
No, that's
so basically it's an automated archiving system that goes through online information and copies it to another host.
Right. Well,
that's especially necessary for instance, if you use BPress so that the materials aren't hosted on your own site. Right? So this way you have another copy of it somewhere else.
I mean, and that's the million-dollar question in my mind is the, so if you have the last copy of a book, so you preserve it, and then you digitize it to make it available to everybody. Well, you still you have digital copies and the one copy of the book. So it's valuable to have both. But if you roll forward, so much of our information now is being produced in digital format. So if it's produced originally in digital format, backing it up or preserving it gets to be kind of backing it up with ephemera in my mind. So it's a tricky issue. But something that we will have to take up at a later time. We're down to less than a minute. So first of all, I want to thank everybody who is on the call. Greg, Sarah, Melissa, Emily and Elizabeth in Florida, and Ken, And Holly just left a minute ago to talk with Terry Gross. Marcia, my co-host, thank you very much, everybody, for being here. And
thanks for having us, Rich.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Then this is one. This is the awkward part of the podcast. We have 10 seconds left, and I can't think of a clever way of signing off. So I'll just say, until we meet again, happy trails, or something like that.
Right.
We're done. We're no longer
recording. All right,
thanks.
Bye. Bye.
Thanks.
Bye.
I'll see you all in Philly, if not before.
All right, let's hope it's not 103 degrees this time.
Oh, my God. You know, that's the one thing about Philadelphia. It can get hot. Hey, Greg, before you hang up, are you I think it would be a really great idea to get maybe Corey and Pablo Arredondo and a bunch of people from the startups on a podcast to talk about stuff. What do you think?
I think so. You know, we had Anurag from Google Scholar years ago came on, so it wouldn't be unheard of, and I think they would be happy.
I'll be in touch.
Okay. Hey, and we may look at maybe bringing in someone from the other coast with the Iron Tech Lawyer thing that Georgetown does.
Awesome.
So Roger can help us out with that.
Right. Right.
That would be way cool.
All right, man.
All right. Take it easy.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.